Here we are, second full day of practice. You might have thought that it was going to get easier, but sometimes the second day has its own unique flavor of dukkha. Dukkha is a word for suffering. It usually takes about 3 days to land. Let's check in on the fourth day and see how things are going. But the room is really settled in. I really have been appreciating the stillness here and the silence. And also starting to meet with people today. It brings out a whole other sense of the group. And I really enjoyed meeting with people. And Jane did too. I wanted to start the talk this evening with a story of a figure that's well known in Sufi lore and in Dharma land, and that's the figure of Mullah Nasruddin. How many people are familiar with Mullah Nasruddin? Just a few, okay. So Mullah Nasruddin, there's lots of stories lots of teaching stories that he expresses with his students. And he's a kind of wise man, fool, eccentric, and the stories are both humorous and elucidating, beneficial. So this one story is about Mullah, who is going back and forth between Turkey and Persia. In those days, it was called Persia. And each time he'd go across the border, he'd go with his donkey, which was carrying some straw, and they'd meet the customs officials on one side, and they'd search Mullah and the donkey and the straw, looking for contraband, and then the other side, same. And he would go back a week later, and again with the donkey and the straw, but each time he'd go back and forth, he'd look a little bit wealthier, like he was up to something and doing some kind of smuggling. But they could never find anything on him, or the donkey, or the straw. And this went on for months, until finally one of the customs officials meets Mullah in a bazaar, and he says, "Look, I've retired. I have a pension. I won't say a word to anyone. We know you were smuggling something. You just have finer clothes each time you go across and look like you're getting richer and richer. Tell me, I promise, I won't say a word. What were you smuggling?" And Mullah looks at him and he says, "Oh, simple. I was smuggling donkeys." And that story shows that sometimes you're looking for the jewels, for the gems, and the precious, valuable jewels, and it's right under your nose, but you can't see it. And that's what I want to talk about tonight. Another list, classical list. For those left-brain people, you'll be happy. And for the right-brain people, this is about working with the difficulties and emotions that come up while you're sitting. This is the list that's called the five hindrances. Some of you are probably quite familiar with it. It's one of the main lists in this teaching. The five hindrances. And these are the jewels that are right under your nose that you say, gosh, if only this wasn't around, I'd be doing great. I'd really be learning a lot. Not realizing that this is where the learning is taking place. The richest learning of all. These hindrances, they're called hindrances because they hinder clarity when they're not seen. When we get entranced or lost or confused in these difficult energies. But when they are seen, they are the riches of the practice. Because the more you can understand and work with them and not be confused by them, here in the practice, in the formal meditation practice, the more you are able to work with them in your life, and the very things that usually confuse become a source of great wisdom and compassion and awakening. So, big five. And you'll probably recognize these. And it's comforting to know that they've been spoken about for thousands of years, as long as humans have had a mind and they are looking into it. And the Buddha spoke about it quite specifically. So the first hindrance when we don't see it is that of the wanting mind, desire, attachment to desire. In the Four Noble Truths, this is the second truth. There is suffering in life, that's the first truth, and the cause of suffering is attachment to desire. Now I just want to say a word about the word desire. Desire is a pretty tricky word because sometimes people say, well, should I get rid of all desire? And no. First of all, it's part of being human, but there are some very healthy desires. There's the desire to come and learn how to meditate. I think that's a good one. There's a desire to learn to open your heart and to express your caring and to see clearly. Or to develop whatever gifts you've been given in this life and offer them to the world, whether it's through your livelihood or through your talents or your creativity or whatever it is. So that kind of desire is, the Pali word for that desire is chanda, which means a desire that will benefit others, or that is a healthy, something that's healthy that you're developing within yourself. That's different from the other kind of desire, which is called tanha in the teachings. Tanha, which means thirst. There's this unquenchable feeling, I need this to be happy, and there's a contraction of mind. This wanting mind, and you've probably seen it since you've been here, have you noticed? Coming up, either thinking about something that would be nice when you get at home, thinking about someone, thinking about, when you can go lie down and take it easy, wanting something in the meditation. And when you're caught in desire, or in attachment, I should say, attachment to the desire, you have very narrow vision, tunnel vision, where you're just focused on that one thing. Like, for instance, you're sitting here in the meditation hall, and there can be sounds of the birds going on outside and sounds of nature, sounds in the hall. But by 35 minutes, and you're waiting for this meditation to end, there's only one sound that really counts. When are they going to ring that damn bell? And then it rings and it's, oh, okay. So we get very focused in wanting a certain thing. And even the way that it works, even when we have what we want, we are so swept up by the wanting that we are not often even able to appreciate and enjoy what's here right now. Have you noticed, you know, you can be out in nature, beautiful scenery, it's so gorgeous here, and then the mind is thinking about what you'd really like to be doing back home, and miss out on nature. I have a story that I wrote about in my book that really communicates the essence of this predicament, and that's of our son, Adam, who is now 29, and when he was very young, each spring we teach a retreat in down in Southern California, and for many years went down there with our family, and when Adam was about 2 and a half, he was down there with us, and I used to spend snack time with him. It was our time in the afternoon after I had spent time with the retreatants and done practice discussions. It was this one afternoon. I was in the staff dining room, and Adam and I were just alone by ourselves. And there was this big bowl of strawberries, his favorite food, really big, luscious strawberries. And he was just so delighted. And there he was stuffing these strawberries in his mouth, juice running down his face. And I, in my naivete, wanted him to learn how to do eating meditation. I wanted him to learn to just taste the food, right? So, I mean, everybody else was doing it, all other 150 people around. You know, why not my 2-year-old son? So, there he was, and I was saying, "Hey, Adam, taste that strawberry. It tastes so good." And he didn't want to hear any of that. And he just kept on grabbing more. And I took the bowl out of his reach, and I said, "Go ahead, taste that." And he leans forward. He's got this big strawberry in his mouth, and he's going, in this one moment that I'll never forget, he's saying, "Strawberry!" That summed up our problem in a nutshell. There we are in the middle of tasting the strawberry or eating the strawberry, and we can't taste it because we want the next thing. You probably have your own version of this. So this is the first of these hindrances. And the problem with desire is that it's inherently unsatisfying. It's satisfying for a moment, but it's impermanent. And then it goes, and then you want some more. And it keeps us looking outside of ourselves for happiness and completion. Not that it's bad, and I'm all for tasting the strawberry. Don't miss the strawberry. But if your life is about getting the next strawberry, you'll not really be here for it. Mm-hmm. So this is the first one. The second difficulty, second hindrance that's common to all meditators is the opposite of wanting, which is aversion. I don't want. And this can have a whole range of expressions, just like desire can have a whole range of expressions, from wanting and interest and then lust or obsession, a whole spectrum of wanting. And aversion can as well, from mild irritation or annoyance to anger and ill will and hatred and aggression and cruelty. The human heart is capable of anything. Aversion comes very commonly in the meditation. Maybe you've seen it. I don't like this mind state. I don't like this body sensation. I don't like being here for this meditation retreat. I don't want this moment to be the way it is. And when we are caught in aversion, there is a very contracted, agitated kind of mind. It's not as seductive or compelling as desire, because sooner or later it doesn't feel good. But we can get very hooked on aversion, and some people feel really alive in their power when they're either blaming or angry, because there is some energy in it. But sooner or later it's not so pleasant. We say somebody is boiling with anger. You can just feel the unpleasantness in it. Notice when for you it's come up in these last couple of days. It's all just part of being human. And it keeps us from seeing clearly. So that's the second. Attachment or desire, aversion. Third is something that's been mentioned a few times here. Classically, it's called sloth and torpor, which is another way of saying sleepiness and dullness of mind. Anybody have it? Everybody raised their hands before, so I know it's so common. And you can be experiencing, you come in the hall, okay, I'm going to be mindful. And then you have what are called the nods, kind of nodding out. Yeah, I have spent hours and hours, probably weeks, if you put it all together, in that mode. I know it well. And it's common.
Yes? Sorry, I'm just getting really scared about the plane touching
oh.
the flower.
Oh, okay, thank you.
Thank you.
That was a good desire. Yeah. Let's see. Where was I? sloth and torpor. Yeah. It's so hard, those first couple of days, to get in touch with your own energy, because we're so used to operating on the outside stimulation of our busy lives. And you come here, not much going on, and what you are being asked to notice is a busy mind or an achy body. This would be a good time to go to sleep. We need entertainment often to keep us interested. And the meditation is one where, as you become more and more mindful, like we were saying last night, the longer, the more the mindfulness, the more things become interesting. But at the beginning, it's not so interesting. And it's you want to head for your bed as much as you can. And it's also true, some people mentioned here in the groups, that sometimes you're just exhausted and you don't even realize how exhausted you are. This is dripping. I can smell it, so I'm going to close it. All of a sudden, since you mentioned, I've been smelling the wax, and then just we get we come here on the retreat, and we're just really exhausted, and we don't even realize how tired we are. And the first day or so, sometimes it's really appropriate to have a good nap and just get yourself refreshed. But after a while, you see the difference between being exhausted and just sluggish. And when you can sense the difference between the two, that sluggishness works itself out. And actually, after a while, your need for sleep, believe it or not, diminishes on retreat. I won't guarantee this, but it's often so that because your mind isn't processing so much stimulation and so many tasks, that it comes to a greater rest, and you find you can stay up a bit later, or you're waking up early and you think, oh, I'll never make it through the day. But you do, because there's a lot more energy that can get released after a while, not usually the first 3 days. And that dullness of mind also expresses itself in a kind of laziness. Oh, do I really need to pay attention? Do I really need to notice this breath? We just had one a moment ago. What's the big deal? Do I really need to do the walking now? Maybe I'll just take it easy. And there is a value, like I said last night, talking about effort, in taking it easy when you're finding yourself getting very tight. But that's a different quality than just laziness. So this is the third, sloth and torpor, dullness, sleepiness, laziness. Fourth hindrance, classical hindrance, is something also that's been mentioned by some people, restlessness. Restlessness, agitation, worry, guilt, they're all in that same category, where the mind is very anxious and flitting about and can't stay focused on anything. Very superficial. Often there's a restlessness in the body, and sometimes the restlessness is about things in the mind. Sometimes things that have happened in the past, where we keep on replaying something over and over. How many people have noticed that since they've been here? Sometimes, and when you think about it, where is the past? Can you turn around quick and catch it? No. The past is a thought that's happening right now in the present moment. But somehow we create this thought and we are lost and toppling backward and keeping on replaying what's happened. I know this one well. The other side is that we can think about something that hasn't happened yet, throw it out into this imaginary place called the future, and then start worrying about it. How many people have found themselves caught in worry about the future? You're not alone. See that? Where is the future? It's a thought that's happening right now in the present moment. But we get caught up in thinking, oh, it's out there, and maybe if I worry enough, I come from a lineage of worriers, right? My mother, bless her heart, she used to say, if I can't think of anything to worry about, that's when I really get worried. Because, as she said, it's like you're putting in your time, and you're just kind of, if you're not worrying, you just are kind of skipping through life thinking everything's going to be fine. But if you put in your time and worry, then you're making good use of your mind. She was joking, of course, but she was joking about herself. There's another Mullah Nasruddin story that comes to my mind of one day he's with his students, and there he is spreading breadcrumbs around the perimeter of his house very meticulously. And his students are watching him, and they say, Mullah, why are you spreading those crumbs around? And he says, oh, I'm doing it to keep away the tigers. And they say, tigers? There aren't tigers for hundreds of miles from here. And he says, effective, isn't it? That's what we do. We kind of keep things at bay by worrying. It's so painful. And yet that's what we do. There's another story of that comes to mind of this artist who is a really excellent artist who goes out one day and he goes on a cave wall and he paints this life-size image of a ferocious tiger. And he does such a good job that when he finishes, he looks up at the tiger, throws up his palette and his brush, and runs out. And that's what we do. We paint these tigers in our mind and frighten ourselves with them. Isn't that an amazing thing that human beings do? We scare ourselves much of the time. So this is the fourth. Restlessness in the body or restlessness in the mind, agitation, worry, regret, guilt. And then the fifth of these hindrances is doubt, the doubting mind. I can't do this. You're sure everybody around is sitting like a Buddha inside and you are having a meltdown. I can't do this. I don't know if this is such a good thing to do anyway. I don't know what the teachers know. We talked about it last night in the talk when I was talking about faith. Doubt comes to everyone, but when it comes, it's really hard to put energy into your practice. It just cuts off all inspiration and attempt to be here. Oh, who cares? Who am I kidding? I was just a phony. So those are the main five. Attachment or desire, aversion, dullness, sleepiness, restlessness, and doubt. Those are the hindrances that have been spoken about for thousands of years. And the good news is that as you start to work with them and see them as just part of being human, then you have real skill and they don't overwhelm you. And you can both have compassion for yourself, wisdom in how to work with them, and compassion for all of us. And when I talk about these five, I'm also going to include all the other difficult emotions that arise while you're sitting. You know, those are the big five that are classically named, but what I'm going to say holds true for any difficult, disturbing emotion, whether it's fear or loneliness or sadness or confusion or whatever it is, impatience, pettiness, judgment. These emotions are part of the process. And as we start to incorporate them in our meditation, you see that there is significant objects of mindfulness as the breath or sensation or sounds. Something to keep in mind about them. They and all the emotions are impermanent. They don't last. No matter how angry you've been. Is it here right now? Maybe if you think of what was making you angry, it came back. But mostly the anger comes and it goes. The sadness comes and it goes. The loneliness comes and it goes. The fear comes and it goes. They are all impermanent. It's so hard to remember that while you're in the middle of it, though. It seems so solid and so real. They are impermanent and they are impersonal. They don't belong to you. They simply arise in your consciousness. As I've said before, you probably don't invite doubt. Let's have some doubt right now. It just comes. Or anger, or any of them. They just come all by themselves, and they leave eventually by themselves in their own time. The only thing that keeps them locked in, not the only thing, the main thing that keeps them locked in is your wanting to get rid of them. Or you're continually thinking of whatever story it is that's triggered it. But when you see they're not yours, there's a tremendous freedom that comes. They are impermanent and they are impersonal. One way you might think of them is like they are just passing weather systems. Today it was really foggy in the morning and then beautiful later on. Yesterday it was rainy for a while. It's not supposed to be sunny and bright all the time. In California, we've had many days where it's sunny and bright, and it's gotten us into real trouble. We've had tremendous drought there. You're not supposed to be sunny and bright all the time. Sometimes you're foggy, sometimes you're stormy, sometimes you're clear and bright, and all the weather systems come and go. It's the natural law. And if you think of these weather systems that visit you in that same way, there is less confusion of, why am I feeling this? Why? What am I doing that's wrong? So, how to deal with these five difficulties? The first strategy will be what the next instructions are, to include them directly in your meditation. You know, so far we've been focusing on the breath and sensations and the physical experience and sounds, but the emotions have probably come. And as I said in one of the groups, it's a little unrealistic that we wait until the third day for the instructions. And I hope you've gotten, I've kind of suggested when a strong feeling comes to let yourself feel it. But to formally include it in the meditation is really powerful and transformative. So I wanted to share with you the first strategy that that you can use, and many people are familiar with this, and I did it in some of the groups today. But something to keep in mind when these feelings come, and that is basically to let them be here and feel the feelings. And there's an acronym that helps you remember this process. And the word is RAIN, R-A-I-N. R stands for recognize. What am I feeling right now? A is allow it to be here. I is investigate, that is, let yourself feel it for just a little while. And the N is non-identification, which means not taking it personally. When you have a strong emotion, these five or any emotion, there's usually three things happening. One, there's a story. I can't believe he did that. Or, I can't believe I'm stuck in this again. How do I get out? What a lousy meditator I am. Whatever the story is. There's a feeling, a mood in the mind. It might be tight, it might be heavy, it might be cloudy or dark or swirling around. Just a whole atmosphere. And there's a feeling in the body, maybe a tightness in your belly or a clenching in your jaw or a constriction in your throat or your heart tight or pounding. And they're all happening at the same time, usually. The story, the mind state, the mental atmosphere, and the physical experience. When we're caught in an emotion, where do you think we hang out of those three? Up in the story. And every time you hit that play button, yeah, he really did do that. Yeah, he really did. And over and over, and we get swept up by the whole energy, not realizing we are just continually pressing that replay button. We were looking at some research that says if you don't mess with an emotion when it comes, that is, just feeling the energy of the emotion, and you don't get caught in the story, and you don't feed it with aversion, the lifespan of most emotions is about 90 seconds. But we mess around with it, don't we? And it can be there for 3 weeks. Or longer. You just keep on hitting that button. So this is how to do the RAIN acronym. And I did it with a few people, and some of you know it, but many of you know it, but just let's do it again in real time. I want to invite you to think of some situation or issue that touches some feelings for you. And you don't have to pick the most intense one, just something that gives you something to work with. You might have an image of that situation or that relationship, and just allow the feeling to come up for a little while. And now we'll go through this RAIN process. first recognize, what am I feeling right now? And just name it in a very kind, neutral way. Oh, it's this. It's sadness, or it's wanting, or it's fear, whatever it is. And now, if you can, allow it to be here for just a few moments. Instead of wanting to get rid of it, give it permission to be here. And as you do, bring an interest to it, rather than having an agenda or getting lost in the story. First notice, where do you feel it in your body? Does it feel a tightness in your belly? Or a constriction in your heart? Just check it out. Be like an explorer. Notice what the sensations are doing in there. Are they heavy? Are they tight? Are they agitated? Are they moving around? Just check it out. Be an investigator. If it feels like it's a lot, then you can just take a few breaths and always get grounded. Just notice what's here. And for a few moments, you might notice what it's like in the mind. Is it heavy? Is it dark? Is it tight? And let it be how it is. Okay, once again, come back into the body and notice what's here now. Maybe it's like it was, maybe it's changed, whatever is okay. Do the sensations stay just the same or change one moment to another? Check it out. And the N, the non-identification, not taking it personally, this is just part of the human experience. This is just something that we all know. Fear or wanting or sadness or confusion or jealousy, whatever it is. Don't take it personally. It can be held in a very kind awareness. It's just here for now. Here for you to understand and learn. And then come back into your physical body and connect a bit with your posture and your breath, and just get grounded in that. And if it feels like you're stirred up, you might take a few moments and do that self-compassion and maybe put your hand on your heart. And just let yourself be grounded that way. And this is hard. This is part of life. May I hold this with kindness. Okay, you can open your eyes if you'd like. So that's the RAIN process. Recognize, what am I feeling right now? Allow it to be here. Investigate, which is different from analyze, not figuring it out, but just letting yourself feel it, and in the end, not taking it personally. You're just exploring for all of us. Mm. That's the first strategy. And then there's, if it seems a bit much, there's the self-compassion. Okay, let me just hold this with kindness and not feel it so directly, but just go, wow, this is really hard. Oh, yeah, this is part of life. May I be kind with myself. If it seems like it's a bit too much and you're really getting overwhelmed, then get grounded and you can feel your body sitting here, you can come back to the breath, you can open your eyes and look around. So all of those things, you don't have to stay with the difficult emotion if it's overwhelming. As long as you're able to be centered around it, fine. Or curious, fine. But when it starts to be too much, then you need to take care of yourself. And as you are feeling any one of these five hindrances or difficult emotions, just get a sense of what your limits are. So you might just make a little agreement, okay, for the next minute or two, let's feel this and then come back. You're just touching it a little each time. So that's the first of the strategies in working with these hindrances, to just let yourself feel them. And often, when you are able to be with it, you might notice that they don't last, that they change. However, here's a warning. Don't look at them hoping that they'll change. Don't say, well, it worked the last time, so if I just pay attention, maybe it'll work now. You can't trick it. It knows if you're trying to trick it. You just really have to allow it to be here. And the good thing about the interest investigation is, while you're wanting to look more carefully at it, you can't at the same time be hoping it'll go away. You can't say, oh, I want to see you. Go away. For a few moments, that aversion is put aside and saying, let's check it out. And that in itself is a shift towards connection. This is a beautiful poem from Jennifer Wellwood called Unconditional. And it's about not running away. Willing to experience aloneness, I discover connection everywhere. Turning to face my fear, I meet the warrior who lives within. Opening to my loss, I gain the embrace of the universe. Surrendering into emptiness, I find fullness without end. Each condition I flee from pursues me. Each condition I welcome transforms me. And becomes itself transformed into its radiant, jewel-like essence. I bow to the one who has made it so, who has crafted this master game. To play it is pure delight, to honor its form, true devotion. So instead of running away from, if you welcome it a little at a time, it becomes transformed and you find a courage that you didn't know you had in you. So that's the first general strategy. Then there are different antidotes that you can bring to each of these as well, and I'll briefly mention them. You might come up with these all on your own, but I'll mention some classical antidotes. So for the wanting mind. Okay. First, letting yourself feel it. But if it's hard to feel, you can reflect on impermanence. What is this going to look like or feel like in a week from now? I really want that. And you can fill it in. Is it going to do it? Has it ever done it? Have you ever had a desire fulfilled and say, I don't need anything else now? Not that you don't want to enjoy it, but it's so seductive thinking, this is going to make me happy. And so reflecting on impermanence is a kind of opens to the truth of things, that it will just be a temporary happiness. That's a good reflection. With aversion, if you can, first feel it. But if it's hard to stay mindful of it and you've done the others, then a good reflection is loving kindness. Loving kindness with yourself. Loving kindness, if your mind is really contracted and it's in anger, thinking of somebody you really love and sending them some loving thoughts kind of softens your heart. If you're really angry at somebody who's doing really hurtful things, then compassion is another reflection. You might think what it's like to be inside somebody's mind that does hurtful things to people. I only have to deal with them when I'm with them. They have to live in that head all the time. And a little compassion goes a long way. So that's a good antidote. With sloth and torpor, sleepiness, it's a little bit harder to be mindful, but it can be done. I don't know if you've ever done this. You ever try to watch yourself fall asleep? You can be up until 3 in the morning. Gee, how do I fall asleep? Well, you can use it to your advantage when you're on the cushion and you're feeling like you're about to pass out. Oh, let's watch myself fall asleep here. You might wake up. You might not. And if you have fallen asleep, don't beat yourself up. Don't make it a big deal. It happens. And you just think, oh, I've had a little nap now. All right, time to come back to the meditation. If you start beating yourself up, all you do is just exhaust yourself. Oh, I fell asleep again. I shouldn't have done that. It just happens. And there are some things that you can do to as antidotes to sleepiness. We've done the standing meditation. You can open your eyes. You can, when you're doing walking, take a nice brisk walk. You can take some deeper breaths. I find this very helpful for my own practice. Just 30 or more seconds on an in-breath. And I'll hold it. And then the same on the out-breath. You do that for a couple of minutes and you'll be energizing yourself. So that's another thing to do. Be playful around it. Here's a little game you can play, I sometimes like, and that is take your thumb and index finger on each hand and interlock them. So you have two circles. And now put them in your lap, and the rest of those fingers can touch, but see if you can keep those circles from touching. It takes some alertness to do that. And as soon as you start falling asleep, come on back, wake up, come on. The idea is to be playful around it, not make it a big problem. So, restlessness, another one. if you can be mindful, oh, restless, restless, restless. Be the first meditator to die of restlessness. We've never lost anyone yet on restlessness, even though it feels like you're going to go. But if you can't be with it, a few things to do. Again, taking some nice deep breaths is a way for all of that energy to be channeled and let go of. You want to probably do it quiet enough so you're not, you know, bellowing the whole room, but nice deep quiet breaths. Standing is again another antidote. If the restlessness is about something that you've done in the past, and there's some guilt around that, one classical contemplation is thinking of some good things that you've done, so that you're not all bad. You know, oh, I did this bad, and then I did that bad. Think of all the good things that you've done, and you've probably done plenty. Just a really kind, generous act. Oh yeah, sometimes I do some not so nice things, sometimes I do some good things. If it's about the future, you don't have enough information yet to know what's going to be. And whenever you're toppling forward, you are off balance. And so refuge is here in the present moment. Here's a little exercise. Just think about something that you're anticipating or worrying about. And imagine it's out there in the future. And if you can reach and touch it, you'll have it all solved. Finally, your worry will come to an end. Right? So play along with me on this. And I'd like you to keep your seat on the cushion and reach. Come on, if you really want it, go for it. It'll be completely fixed. And then you realize it's not going to happen. Just now feel how it feels to be toppling forward. And now slowly let your body come back to center. Notice how that feels. Notice the difference between being caught in worry or anticipation and coming back to center. So that's an antidote for restlessness and worry. And then finally, doubt. If you can, like I shared in that story yesterday, you know, oh, doubting, it's just doubting Buddha. Great, if you can feel it, but sometimes it's not so easy, and so the antidote to doubt is faith. And by that, you can reflect on somebody who inspires you, somebody who believes in you, somebody who's supported you, maybe that benefactor that you used in the loving kindness today. That gives a lot of inspiration. Oh yeah, they believe in me, maybe I can do this. Or their example showed that they have courage, maybe I can too. So those are the big five. And with any of these, you really are looking to go inside and seeing, what do I need right now? Because a lot of the time, you have your own answers right in here. But it's important to see that every time you get caught and you are lost in one of these difficulties can be a learning, part of the learning process. It doesn't have to be a cause for defeat or discouragement, because that's how we grow, by keeping on learning and seeing how we get caught. And so I want to just end with a favorite passage of mine that explains this process of learning. This is called Autobiography in Five Short Chapters by a woman named Portia Nelson. Chapter 1. I walk down the street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I fall in. I'm lost. I'm helpless. It isn't my fault. It takes me forever to find a way out. Chapter 2. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I pretend I don't see it. I fall in again. I can't believe I'm in the same place. But it isn't my fault. It still takes a long time to get out. Chapter 3. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I see it is there. I still fall in. It's a habit. My eyes are open. I know where I am. It is my fault. I get out immediately. Chapter 4. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I walk around it. Chapter 5. I walk down another street. That pretty much describes the process of waking up. And we're spending a lot of time in Chapter 3 when you're here on a retreat. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I see it is there. I still fall in. It's a habit. But my eyes are open. I know where I am. And when she says, it is my fault, not to blame yourself, but just to see, oh, I have a choice here. It's not the problem out there. I can choose. And that's how you can walk around it or walk down another street. So every time you get caught and you see it, great, I see it. And that's how you start giving yourself another choice. So these are the five difficult energies, five hindrances, and any way, working with any difficult emotion, the same principle. They are a very important and rich part of the process. So let's just sit for a moment. Thank you for your attention.